Our third case for this morning is United States v. James Taylor, and we'll hear from Mr. Stevens.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Mr. Taylor was charged with making a false statement to purchase firearms on two occasions, and he pled guilty to that. He wound up being sentenced for an aggravated assault and received a sentence which was approximately four times greater than was originally indicated in the first pre-sentence report. If you look at simply the false statements as they were reported in the original pre-sentence report, the case was sent back to the probation department for the preparation of additional report that would take into account the additional relevant conduct or the additional conduct that ultimately resulted in the sentence that we have here.
So, Mr. Stevens, wouldn't you agree, though, that what you're essentially asking us to do is to extend the holding in Booker all the way out to sentencing factors, a step the Supreme Court certainly has not taken since the time of Booker? It's never said that the indictment clause or anything else applies to sentencing factors, as long as one stays inside the statutory maximum for the crime asserted in the indictment.
No, I'm not asking for that much relief. I'm saying that when the particular guideline that raises the offense level defines its aggravating conduct in terms of another felony, that term, another felony, is a word of art that should carry with it the typical procedures that attach to felony prosecutions in federal court. I have no quarrel at all with the idea that if the Sentencing Commission established conduct as relevant conduct and specified it in it, and if the preponderance of the evidence showed that the defendant engaged in that specific conduct, that the offense level would rise. But what we have here is a very peculiar enhancement. They talk about another felony. So the individual who lied on his firearm application is subjected to basically prosecution for murder, assault, or anything else where a firearm may have been used, and he gets none of the protections that are associated with having to answer to that felony charge.
But what do you do, though, with the fact that the Supreme Court has said that even if there had been an indictment and there was an acquittal, you still get to use that conduct in determining how severe a sentence should be, again, respecting the statutory limits on the crime of indictment?
All of the cases that have looked at acquitted conduct are talking about acquitted conduct in the terms of either specific enhancements to the guidelines or an overall aggravating factor under 3553. This is the only case that I know of where a person essentially has been called to answer a fresh charge under this guideline. And that's really what happened here. I filed a motion to dismiss in the district court, and they said, well, there's nothing to dismiss. And then we were confronted with the confronted with an order where the district judge made a series of suggestions about charges that might qualify as another felony. And then the prosecution went forward with a hearing to try to prove up the aggravated battery under Indiana law. And
but I'm noticing, I thought this was correct, I just wanted to double check, that C1 doesn't refer even to conviction on another felony. It's the commission or attempted commission of another offense. And, you know, it's like, what kind of things have you been doing with your time? You know, and if they've been classified by the state as felonies, that would suggest that a more severe sentence is appropriate. I guess I'm having trouble seeing this as a sub rosa conviction for the underlying felony. It just doesn't seem to fit the structure that the Supreme Court has set forth.
Except that when you look at the proceedings that were followed here, it very much the district court set out in an order prior to the sentencing hearing a number of possible charges, if you will. Then there was evidence that was offered in support of those charges. Witnesses were called, and the court made a determination that factually, basically, that those charges had been proved. And I'm saying that if you're going to engage in that kind of a process, that is, if you're going to try to establish a felony charge, that necessarily involves the basic right to not to be held to answer to an offense unless you've been indicted. And so I think we have here really a very narrow question that turns on on using another felony as a term of art. And what I'm asking is, in a situation where the government undertakes to prove that other felony, that pleading by way of indictment becomes a requirement. I mean, I think that's...
We'll accept that as your argument and see what we think. Thank you. Mr. Schmidt.
Good morning. In this case, the defendant was indicted on two counts of acquiring firearms based on lies to the firearms dealer, and he pled guilty without a plea agreement. The district court imposed a within-guidelines range sentence well within the statutory maximums based on facts that were well established at the sentencing hearing. The Supreme Court has spoken really quite plainly. Judicial fact-finding in the course of selecting a sentence within the authorized range does not implicate the indictment, jury trial, or reasonable doubt components of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. That's from Harris versus United States, 2002 Supreme Court case. The defendant cites and relies on Apprendi, but Apprendi didn't even involve the presentment clause of the Fifth Amendment. Rather, Apprendi made clear that judges may find facts by a preponderance of the evidence at sentencing so long as the resulting sentence does not increase the penalty for a crime beyond the prescribed statutory maximum. This court, too, has made quite clear the same proposition. In Shannon, this court said, quote, district court judges do not violate the Constitution when they find facts by a preponderance of the evidence for purposes of calculating a guideline range, so long as the guidelines remain advisory and the ultimate decision is based on a consideration of 3553A factors. all the other circuits are in accord. In this particular case, the Supreme Court has addressed explicitly a presentment clause argument in a case called United States versus Abdullahi. The defendant there was arguing that her sentencing enhancement on the basis of 17 kilograms of heroin should have resulted in an indictment on that amount. This court summarily dispatched that argument and said, quote, drug quantity is a sentencing factor, and because it is not necessary to establish a violation of the statute in question, the indictment not even included.
I guess what Mr. Stevens is arguing is when this embedded factor is sort of a standalone felony, there should be some different rule.
That's exactly what he's arguing. Because the guidelines make reference to the term felony,
right,
something special is created. There's really no dispute here that this is a sentencing factor, a sentencing enhancement. Mr. Stevens has to concede that. The guidelines are explicit that this is a sentencing factor. They say that the reference to another felony offense means any state or local offense, regardless of whether a criminal charge was brought or a conviction obtained. Elsewhere, the guidelines say conduct that is not formally charged is not an element of the offense of conviction, may enter into the determination of the applicable guideline range. We enhance sentences under the guidelines all the time for conduct that is otherwise could be considered felonious. For example, the obstruction of justice enhancement on the basis of the defendant's perjury, that's otherwise felonious conduct, but that doesn't change it. The Supreme Court has said in United States versus Witt that it doesn't matter how we label sentencing factors. The crucial thing is, does it change the statutory maximum? And here there's no argument that Mr. Stevens and the defense can make that this changes the applicable penalties available here in this case. And I disagree with Mr. Stevens. He said that the aggravated battery conduct resulted in a sentence four times greater. That's not what happened here. It was higher than what was originally outlined in the original pre-sentence report draft, but also take into account the defendant also ended up with an obstruction of justice enhancement based on his perjurious testimony at the sentencing hearing, the first sentencing hearing, and he lost acceptance of responsibility because of those perjurious statements and denying relevant conduct.
Well, in fact, it doesn't really matter how much higher than the original sentencing range without the enhancement would be, as long as it's within the statutory maximum. That's very clear under prevailing Supreme Court case law.
Yes, Your Honor, and under this court's case law as well. The argument has never been made before. Mr. Stevens can't cite a single case to support the argument, and it's just plainly inconsistent with existing Supreme Court authority. Unless you have additional questions, I'll stand on the brief.
Apparently not. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Stevens?
The drug case, the Abdullah case that Mr. Schmidt referred to, is one where the defendant, at the time of her plea, said that there was admitted to a certain quantity of drugs that she had. There is absolutely no question that the sentencing guidelines are, in drug cases, driven largely by drug quantity. So when the government shows at sentencing that she had more drugs than she admitted, they are simply applying a well-established sentencing guideline that says, we base it on drug quantity, and we've proved more drugs. That is a good example of where the guideline sets out specific conduct which the government is free to establish by a preponderance of the evidence without any fresh charges and so forth, because the conduct is defined by the guidelines themselves. When you have a statement, as we do in this case, where you take the entire universe of another felony conduct, none of the protections that go with the specificity of those guidelines are present. And that's exactly why I'm saying that the indictment clause should apply in this narrow case alone.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And you were appointed, were you not? We appreciate your service very much to your client. And thank you as well to the government. We'll take the case under